From pop culture to politics, this is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth, where one of the greatest columnists working today in this great nation, a columnist who is not afraid of controversy, controversy with the left, and controversy occasionally with the right. His name, Brett Stevens. He writes for the New York Times, where his column appears Thursdays and Saturdays. And a recent column is headlined with the proclamation, Biden's plan promises permanent decline. Should Americans choose permanent decline? The immediate prior column, which I hope to get to first, suggests that the Democrats and progressives in this country may be facing a pushback of major proportions. Over what? Over issues of race. Brett, first of all, thanks so much for joining us. In
your
column about the potential pushback against the Democrats, one of the things you focus on is the term and the concept of white privilege. Does the rejection by most Americans, the great majority of Americans, the idea that there is a special privilege that white people enjoy, is that just a product of racism, or what is it based on?
Well, I mean, there is this notion afoot that whites in this country, by virtue of their race, have enjoyed this kind of unearned privilege for which they are supposed to feel apologetic. And my suggestion in the column is that if you ask working class folks all over the country, people in Appalachia, people who come from Irish communities historically, or underprivileged communities or ethnicities that have a white skin but not a WASPish pedigree, Catholics in America have all struggled to earn their place here. And so the term, I think, is going to offend a great deal of what used to be the traditional Democratic Party constituency of working class people of all races, including including whites. So I think it's for the Democrats, I mean, I'm just talking politically, I think it's a potentially toxic term. And I think it's going to increasingly hurt them if they continue to adopt a very racialized style of politics.
You you quote in your column, and it's a devastating quote. I've used it on the air before in your name. But you quote Ibram X. Kendi, who is the most important anti-racist thinker, saying that he believes that the only remedy to past discrimination is present discrimination. And the only remedy to present discrimination is future discrimination. You know what that reminded me of? And stay with me here for just a moment. What that reminded me of is it's basically saying discrimination today, discrimination tomorrow, discrimination forever, which was kind of an echo of what George Wallace said.
George Wallace.
Segregation now, segregation tomorrow, segregation forever.
No, well, listen, and this is an important point. You know, we now, I think a lot of Americans are unaware that the term anti-racism is not what a normal person would suppose, right? Of course, you and I, and hopefully every decent American, is against racism. But the term anti-racism has a very specific ideological, not just a connotation, a denotation. People like Ibram Kendi and Robin DiAngelo are sort of the high priests of it. But to anyone who actually stops and reads their work, it just seems like another form of racism, not a bid to create an equal society, but a bid to turn the tables. And again, I think, you know, you have conversations with liberal Americans, and although many of them are nervous about speaking out loud, they are very uneasy with this because it just strikes them as a form of racism in a different guise. Racism is a kind of a retributive form of discrimination, but discrimination is what we were all raised to oppose. We were all raised on Martin Luther King Jr.'s creed of being judged by the content of our character, not the color of our skin. And this is a rejection of that view.
As speaking of the content of our character, that brings me to your other piece, which every American should read, about Biden's plan and the promise of permanent decline. And you take a look at France, which has a tremendous amount of social spending. And you write in your piece that investments like these, once made, are almost never reversed. The spending will become permanent, transforming America into a kinder, gentler place of permanent decline. How do we know that?
Well, look, you know, let me frame this. I have lived in Belgium. I have lived in Germany. I have lived in the UK. My children have American and EU citizenship. I'm not anti-European. But I know Europe. And Europe, as a force in the world, both strategically and economically, has been in decline for more than 40 years. And a large part of the reason is that they have exchanged what used to be tremendous economic dynamism and a sense of innovation for social welfare states. And those states certainly provide things that people might want to have, but they tend to come at the same cost that all forms of socialist or socialist-minded forms of economics produce, which is to say, huge amounts of taxation, well north of 50% of incomes, labor regulations, which are terrific if you're in the job market, but terrible if you're trying to get into the job market. Therefore, very high unemployment, and therefore kind of slow stagnation. I mean, anyone who actually follows the news from France, constant labor unrest, constant strikes, political paralysis, the rise of the far right, the far left, should understand that this is not a happy utopia. This is not a happy place. And so we ought to take a very hard look at France before we decide to imitate it.
And if there were one item on the Biden agenda that he has put forward so far that you think is most necessary to turn back, what would it be?
Look, I think, first of all, the raising taxes is always going to be a bad idea. It's going to hurt not just sort of people we traditionally think of as zillionaires, but a lot of people who are, quote, rich because they have small businesses. They're entrepreneurs. They're job creators. But the really difficult part is the social spending, because it's one thing to invest in a road. You invest in a road and then you have to maintain it, but it's not really, in a sense, that permanent annual investment. It's the mandatory spending, which never goes away and which increasingly eats up an ever larger share of the budget. We spend most of our federal dollars on spending that we can't avoid because we've made commitments, and those commitments are going to end up taking us on the road either to insolvency or to a lot of social unrest. So again, think carefully, because in life there's no such thing as a free lunch.
And one of the dirty words, the FCC hasn't banned it yet, but maybe they should, is entitlement. The whole idea of establishing new entitlements to which the American people have a right to feel entitled means that the kind of wild deficit spending that we're talking about now is likely to continue. Brett Stevens, we have links to his work posted at our website at michaelmedved.com. And he is a very much needed and always pertinent voice. When we come back, we will get to the bizarre trend of getting high on rotten meat. Is that really a sign of social progress or multiculturalism, perhaps? And a claim that America is now living on borrowed time. Why? Coming up on The Medved Show. On the Michael Medved show, one of the many, many, many indications that insanity seems to be the order of the day in many precincts of American culture. There is a report in a number of sources. It's not just the New York Post. It's actually, this is from Newsweek. And they write of all the bizarre and dangerous trends to gain traction on social media, a practice known as high meat might be all the all-time grossest and most nauseating. Okay, what do they mean by high meat? The appalling diet trend, Newsweek writes, encourages people to let raw meat rot for several months or even a year before eating it. Once adequately rancid, the decomposed raw meat, also known as high meat, is consumed. And supposedly a euphoric high soon overtakes the person eating it. Well, that might be associated with death, actually. While some reportedly eat high meat for its alleged mind-altering effects, others actually say they prefer the taste of the rotting flesh, which is, quote, often described as cheesy and more acidic than your average steak. Okay. Online discussion about high meat has surged since a series of viral tweets brought newfound attention to the little-known practice. And those tweets include pictures, photographs, color photographs of what the meat looks like and the idea of actually consuming it not only seems unsafe, but nauseating. Despite the anecdotal claims of high meat advocates, experts are resounding in their opposition to the trend. You think? Noting that eating rancid raw meat can cause illness. Anaras Lapsis, a Singapore-based consultant dietitian, reported that it's possible that a whole range of bacteria present in rotten meat could be behind the reported high or hallucination or the feeling of euphoria. However, it's simply a matter of luck as to whether or not the high meat will make the person eating violently ill. Quote, all sorts of bacteria, Salmonella, Shigella, E. coli, all of these things that our human body might really struggle with breaking down. In addition to food poisoning, the experts note that the consumption of high meat has the potential to cause uncontrollable bowel movements, large intestinal damage, vomiting, dehydration, and even botulism. So the advice, this could, yeah, right, but what a way to go, huh? I mean, what is crazy about this, this sounds crazy, I know, but look at the people who shoot heroin, right? At least heroin is more likely to give you a high, but what it does to your body, the dangers of shooting heroism are meth, what meth does to your teeth. And people are addicted to this. Now, I'm not suggesting that you need some kind of new governmental program. But when this fad becomes a thing that is written about all over the place, then maybe we should be a little bit more careful of the inspiration we take from social media. And then there's this. There's a piece by Christopher DeMuth in the Wall Street Journal today called America's Welfare State is on Borrowed Time. And he writes about, has anyone noticed that President Biden has proposed increasing federal spending by nearly $1 trillion a year while promising that 98% of Americans will pay nothing for it? The very idea would have seemed mad to every previous generation of Americans. Today it is considered consequential, or a conventional, pardon me. He says, set aside all the problems and take the Biden plans as advertised, as a tremendous expansion of government paid for by a select few taxpayers, plus lots of new borrowing. This is the apotheosis of political transformation that began in the 1970s. And what he's talking about is it's not just Biden. This was already true of some Republican presidents, including Trump, and including Ronald Reagan, who greatly expanded the federal budget deficit and the national debt. And the difficulty here is eventually somebody has to pay. You are living on borrowed time. Christopher DeMuth writes, and Christopher DeMuth is with the Hudson Institute, the conversion of the IRS to a social welfare agency would continue apace under the Biden plans, with their profusion of targeted tax credits for families and green energy. Whatever the future may hold, the provision of borrowed benefits is deeply corrupting of democracy. It absolves citizens of recognizing their dependence on one another and politicians of accountability for managing the conflicts and constraints of today's society. Instead, it encourages the fantasy that there are Croesuses out there, Croesus being a legendary wealthy individual in Roman history. There are Croesuses out there in our midst whose fair share will pay for the benefits government wants to give us. This, too, is a central element of the Biden plan. The difficulty of all of this is creating new entitlements means that they inevitably grow. And there's another aspect to this, which is one of the things that government does is it changes our culture. And government will often set up standards. If all of a sudden the government is saying it doesn't matter how much we borrow, it doesn't matter how much interest we pay, we want this now, we need this now, we're going to borrow more and more and more and more, doesn't that serve as encouragement for Americans to go into deeper and deeper debt that they have no chance of paying off? Wasn't that one of the problems in the housing bubble that crashed with such devastating impact in 2008? You may remember there were all kinds of people who were borrowing money to pay for houses that they couldn't possibly afford. How can we afford all of the changes in infrastructure, the provision of all of a sudden new federally financed daycare, the provision of new federally financed pre-K education, the provision for junior college for all? Now, I think it makes sense to make it more possible for people to go to junior college. I think that makes, but to community college, used to call it junior college. But again, to talk about no consequences, a real problem that even some people on the left are beginning to recognize. We'll get to that coming up on the MedVet Show.
The greatest show on God's green earth.
I'm sorry, but that is the truth.
The Michael Medved Show.
And on the Michael Medved Show, according to all of the insiders and to many members of the Congress of the United States, there is about to be a change in the leadership of the Republican Party in the House of Representatives. Not in the number one or number two positions. That will continue to be Kevin McCarthy of California, who is the House Minority Leader, soon to become Speaker, with any luck at all. And number two position, Steve Scalise of Louisiana, who has actually endorsed a replacement for number three, who is Liz Cheney. And there are a bunch of mistakes about what is going on with Liz Cheney that I think it's worth trying to correct. And I also want to get to a powerful column that she wrote today in the Washington Post. In the range of mistakes, there is a general assumption that Trump loyalists in the House Republican minority are punishing Liz Cheney because she was one of the 10 members, 10 Republican members who voted to impeach President Trump, to send the impeachment to the Senate. And Kevin McCarthy insists that is not true, and his actions prove that that's not true. It was long after impeachment that there was an initial drive to basically dump Liz Cheney because she was anti-Trump. She had voted for impeachment. But when the Republican members of the House voted, she won by a more than 2-to-1 margin. And that Kevin McCarthy had given a passionate speech in her support, saying we have to have room in our party for all points of view. And so she continued in her position as chairman of the House conference. According to the Wall Street Journal, the key factor in the falling apart of the relationship between Liz Cheney and Kevin McCarthy came in late February. House GOP leaders were wrapping up a news conference criticizing Democrats' coronavirus relief bill when a reporter asked if Mr. Trump should be invited as a speaker at a conservative conference that weekend. That would be the CPAC conference where he gave a lengthy speech. And Mr. McCarthy said, yes, he should. The reporter then asked to hear from Ms. Cheney. And rather than standing together with her leader, the leader of the House Republicans, or dodging the question, it's easy to say, well, that's not a decision for us to make. It's a decision that I trust that they will make over at CPAC, at the Conservative Political Action Conference. She could have said that easily. She didn't. With McCarthy standing right there, she said, I've been clear on my views about President Trump and the extent to which, following January 6th, I don't believe that he should be playing a role in the future of the party or of the country. A few weeks after that February news conference, Mr. McCarthy began to skip House GOP leadership media events with Ms. Cheney and other leaders, instead fielding questions on his own. He began calling her comments a distraction. And I think the difficulty that McCarthy faces is Liz Cheney is a solid conservative. By the way, she's about to be replaced, I've mentioned, by Stefanik, who is, and Elise Stefanik is less conservative in her voting record in Congress by far than Liz Cheney. Liz Cheney has a 78% voting record of agreeing with the American Conservative Union. And Elise Stefanik has only 43%. Elise Stefanik, for instance, voted against Trump's tax cuts, which was one of his most beneficial domestic projects. She voted, she expressed criticism of his decision to pull out of the Paris Accords. Now, on both of those issues, President Trump got support from Liz Cheney. So what this is about, it seems to me, is not who's more conservative. It's not who voted for impeachment or who didn't. It's basically who's going to be a team player. And to be a team player, and you kind of have to be, to be in the House leadership, you have to pay attention to where the people who have chosen you for that post are. You have to represent them. And the majority of Republican House members, I believe shamefully, voted to challenge the election results. They don't agree with Liz Cheney. If she kept quiet about it or said, well, we can disagree on this and still agree on most agenda items, it would be one thing. But she can't. And her column today in the Washington Post is powerful. She begins by saying, in public statements again this week, former President Donald Trump has repeated his claims that the 2020 election was a fraud and was stolen. His message, I am still the rightful president and Joe Biden is illegitimate. Trump repeats these words now with full knowledge that exactly this type of language provoked the violence on January 6th. And as the Justice Department and multiple federal judges have suggested, there is good reason to believe that Trump's language can provoke violence again. Trump is seeking to unravel critical elements of our constitutional structure that make democracy work. Confidence in the result of elections and the rule of law. No other American president has ever done this. The Republican Party, she writes, is at a turning point, and Republicans must decide whether we are going to choose truth and fidelity to the Constitution. Then she says, I am a conservative Republican, and the most conservative of conservative values is reverence for the rule of law. Each of us swears an oath before God to uphold our Constitution. The Electoral College has spoken. More than 60 state and federal courts, including multiple Trump-appointed judges, have rejected the former president's arguments and refused to overturn election results. That is the rule of law. That is our constitutional system for resolving claims of election fraud. The difficulty here is, of course, she's right on all these things. And I do respect her greatly for her willingness to basically go down on her principles. She says at the end of her piece, our children are watching. We must be brave enough to defend the basic principles that underpin and protect our freedom and our democratic process. I am committed to doing that no matter what the short-term political consequences might be. Well, the consequences for her are going to be difficult because it seems to me that if you are in a position of leadership in the House, your focus has to be on doing whatever you possibly can to keep the Republican Party united. Her colleagues know where she stands on these issues, and I believe they were willing to re-elect her to her position as chairman of the conference. What they weren't willing to do was to have her representing them and to accentuate this issue. This issue, whether it comes from Liz Cheney or from Donald Trump, the issue of recounting the votes and rehashing the election and basically implying that it was a stolen election, this is not the way the Republicans are going to win back the House of Representatives and should win back the Senate as well, which is something the country needs. And I think that actually it's something that Joe Biden desperately needs to prevent going off the rails in a deeply destructive direction. When we come back, if anybody wants to call on this, you can. It's 1-800-955-1776. When we come back, I want to get to an analysis by Pew of the way that people in different religious groups are responding to the Biden administration, because one of the things it indicates is that the path to a permanent Democratic majority may be difficult, if not impossible. All coming up on the MedVet Show. Survey from the Pew Research Center about the way that people of different religious groups are responding to Joe Biden. And it's actually fascinating, especially when you compare it to similar questions, identical questions, in fact, that were asked about of people from the same mix of religious backgrounds about President Trump. Because it turns out that if you just look at the surface here, it looks like Biden's doing pretty well, that he has approval from a lot of groups, except what it shows is that there is almost no increase in support. This is the same breakdown that the exit polls show that he got in the election. And there is one group that overwhelmingly disapproves of Biden in every way, white evangelical Protestants. White evangelical Protestants, 75% disapprove of Joe Biden, 23% approve. And this is a very serious matter for reasons that we will explain. I do want folks to be aware that if you are a MedHead member, go to our MedHead site and go ahead and access our new In the Light of History podcast about President Reagan's most consequential tax cut. He cut the top rate of taxes from 50% down to 28% in one bill. And he won overwhelming Democratic approval to do it. How? Go to our podcast to find out. And also check out, when you're at our website, you can sign up for our free newsletter. So you get a whole bunch of movie reviews tomorrow in addition to other elements of commentary and information and background. And you can also sign up for free for our newsletter or for free for our crowd, which has all kinds of information about new high-tech opportunities. Back to this, the conclusions of this religious breakdown of people's responses to Joe Biden. He, the one area where he is doing notably better than Trump has been on the one group in the American population that has been most closely divided in terms of its religious loyalty. In other words, religiously unaffiliated, overwhelmingly anti-Trump and pro-Biden. Hispanic Catholics, overwhelmingly pro-Biden. White evangelical Protestants, overwhelmingly pro-Trump and anti-Biden. But here's the interesting thing that shows something of a switch, is that among white Catholics, which is a big chunk of Americans, it's shows that Trump was narrowly divided with 52% approval and 47% disapproval. And for Biden, it's 51% approval and 48% disapproval. In other words, it's virtually identical. The idea that Biden has additional support because he happens to be a white Catholic, that hasn't panned out for him. But this is what's fascinating. They asked also this question: across most religious groups, more people like Biden's conduct than like Trump's. They asked this question. What do you say? Do you like the way the president conducts himself in office? And you can say, like, mixed feelings, don't like. And for Joe Biden, he's ahead by that measure of where Trump was, except for white evangelical Protestants, where 59% don't like the conduct of President Biden. And what this indicates, of course, is that what President Trump won in terms of overwhelming support from white evangelical Protestants is often talked about as a passing change in American politics. It wasn't really a change because white evangelicals have been voting Republican in pretty good numbers ever since Reagan. But what is necessary is for people to understand how important this voting group is. In the last election, according to exit polls, 28% of all voters described themselves as white, evangelical, or born-again Christians. That's almost a third. And they went for Trump by 76% to 24%. They went for Trump 3-1. And what's fascinating to me is there is so much discussion about Republicans trying to make a dent in the so-called non-white community. There is no single one non-white community. The differences are very real. That's my Newsweek column that's going to be in our newsletter this week. The differences between blacks and Latinos and Asians are very significant, aside from the differences, of course, within each community. But what's fascinating to me is that if you take a look at the Black, Latino, and Asian population together, it's almost exactly the same amount as the white evangelical Christians alone. And you know what? Here's the fascinating thing. Republicans are doing better among non-white people than Democrats do among white evangelical Christians. So why isn't that group in the electorate considered more of a battleground? I mean, Democrats are going to have a very tough time winning elections, certainly the elections coming up, if the number and their performance among white evangelicals remains so dubious and so weak, frankly. Coming up, there's a new movie that's opening up on various streaming services this weekend that we reviewed a while ago, but it's actually a fairly interesting science fiction thriller. It's not about a mission to Mars. It's about a mission to a planet to be used as an alternate refuge for humanity. Listen.
Now it's time for MedVed's Entertainment Minute.
Near the beginning of an 86-year mission to outer space, the crew of specially bred teenagers comes to believe there's something wrong with the blue stuff they have to drink every day in Voyagers, now available on various streaming platforms.
Medication to decrease pleasure.
What's going on? They're drugging us.
Well, this development puts the only middle-aged adult on the spaceship in a difficult situation in what's been described aptly as Lord of the Flies in outer space. The young cast, headed by Lily Rose Depp and Ty Sheridan, is universally strong, and writer-director Neil Berger makes this a high-tech thriller that's genuinely thought-provoking. The problem is, when you think about it too much, there are some real gaps in logic, but it's still compelling entertainment. Rated PG-13, despite disturbingly realistic violence and some racy sexual content. 3 stars for Voyagers, which is probably worth the trip. Not an 86-year trip, and it does feel somewhat long and extended at points. But I do think people might enjoy it. I know you will enjoy. Tomorrow, we have a question, which is, can activists get any more foolish? They are now in Chicago calling for a ban on police foot chases. Really? In other words, if a dangerous criminal is running away, you just wave goodbye? This has not been enacted yet, but it is a serious demand. And when the left gets serious in Chicago, they can have a real impact, I guess. There's also a fascinating lawsuit where a homeowner, a black homeowner, had decorated his house with African themes and paintings of civil rights leaders. And then he got an appraisal, and he believes and says he can prove that the appraisal was lowered because of his display of such black symbols. And that led to a $100,000 decrease in his appraisal. We'll talk about that lawsuit. We will also be taking a look at a new movie with Jason Statham, plus a Billy Crystal tearjerker with Tiffany Haddish, and much more to review. All this coming up next time in This Greatest Nation on God's Green Earth.